Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2001, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is a historian. His interests are wide. He's as much at home among the affluent charms of the 17th century Netherlands as he is in the bloodthirsty turn of 18th century France. People and paintings, food and music populate his works as easily as great events or political movements. He's now brought history to an ever wider audience as the author and presenter of the BBC television series A History of Britain. An Oxbridge exile who's found the freedom he needs teaching and working in America, he still thinks of the great English historians as patriarchs of the craft. You're not doing your job properly, he believes, unless you've equipped yourself with the skills to make history work with the broad reading public. He is Simon Sharma. So, Simon, is it the communication of history that drives you as much as the history itself?
Well, I do love the writing, and actually I do think in some of the models who I revere, going all the way back to Herodotus, there was a gossipy relish. So there is this element of actually chatting by the campfire, which I think is wonderful. And I think actually if a historian only thinks of himself as undertaking a seminar and not spending time in a company of friends, the thing isn't going to come alive.
And not storytelling, which is what
storytelling is crucial. We're historians are just holding the baton of this tribal storytelling right between our grandpas and our grandchildren.
You do get criticised, nevertheless, by those kind of historians who are kind of chiselling away at the rock face of history. They say that you go less for the analysis and more for the atmosphere, that in a sense you're making some of it up. You're taking people to the front line in 1066 or to a bloodthirsty Paris in Revolution, and you are imagining what it must have been like to be there. And they consider that it distorts the truth.
Right. Well, I don't think it does at all. I think actually, Macaulay, you're right. Impossible and bigoted and prejudiced in some ways, very profoundly insightful, you know, all of 25 years old, and said actually history must be burnt into the imagination before it can be received by the reason. Your first duty is absolutely to connect. You're asking people to see a kind of weird relationship with those who've gone before them. You're asking them to enter this company of people with whom they ought to have a connection.
And indeed, you do make these extraordinary connections. I mean, that is very much what you do, isn't it?
I see literary doodling.
I see one of the latest ones is, I don't know whether it's latest, but certainly one that shocked me and I hadn't come across before, was you're saying that we'd replaced Anthony Eden with Nobby Stiles. I mean, do you want to...
Did I say that?
Do you want to sell me that one quickly?
No, I don't.
Loss of Suez replaced by winning a World Cup.
I suppose what I meant, they were 10 years apart, but when the empire finally went down the drain with Suez, a lot of the intense chest-thumping, flag-waving need for tribal noise transferred itself to England.
More entertaining connections to come in the meantime. Tell me about your first piece of music.
First piece of music is Cole Porter, You're the Top, and he makes the most extraordinary connection. So, Mahatma Gandhi rhyming with Napoleon Brandy, Inferno's Dante rhyming with the nose of Durante. But my dad was... The first music I heard was show tunes. Our house was full of show tunes in... My parents used to sing. You wouldn't know if supper was coming, or they'd go into another chorus of There's No Business Like Show Business. My mother thought she was Ethel Merman for a moment. I mean, my father thought he was Ethel Merman, which was more worrying.
You're the top. You're Mahatma Gandhi. You're the top. You're Napoleon Brandy. You're the purple light of a summer night in Spain. You're the National Gallery, your gobble salary, your cellophane. You're sublime. You're a turkey dinner. You're the time.
You're the Top, sung by Cole Porter. In honour of your father, that one. He was, it seems from everything I've read about him, a kind of theatrical impresario monk, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. He actually sold textiles for a living and he hated it. He used to walk me around the garment district in order to tell me what not to do. He said, this is a horrible life. I'm going to show you just how horrible it is. And he'd point to people and say, him, he's an incredible crook. He's a scoundrel. I said, I've got the point, Dad. I've got the point. And he said, do what your heart wants. Well, his heart wanted. He was in love. Jewish as he was, an East End boy though he was so deeply in love with performed English language.
So he gave you all these books, did he? I mean,
we used to read. In between Ethel Merman, we had Dickens readings out loud at home sometimes. And this got completely out of control because when my father's business got a bit ropey, as it often did, the way my mother used to say, this is not good, was to sort of quote David Copperfield. So the worst thing that she could say was, you're Mr. Micawber. And I used to, my head was thought, okay, we're off to the workhouse. Do I get second gruel? You know, we're in the workhouse. So this is totally horribly literal.
But he was kind of actor manager to your juvenile lead, apparently. He put you on the platform.
Right. He took me, the first Shakespeare we saw, it was absolutely extraordinary. It was Richard Burton, Henry V, and I was about 8 years old or something. And I could smell what I thought was history. It was actually grease paint, but it was something I'd never smelt before. But this was in order to apprentice me to sort of doing these little freak Shakespeare recitations on where all the others would be doing Sir Patrick Spence or Mary Had a Little Lamb. I could still do it, and I won't. The speech before Harfleur in a sort of 7-year-old voice, once more onto the breach, dear friends.
But where were you doing it? Where
I was doing this at school, and then we had these debating societies. Little Jewish boys in white-on-white shirts with sort of knitted silk ties debating in places like Stepney whether or not Britain should undertake unilateral nuclear disarmament. We were sort of 11-year-old Michael Furths, really. And my father, he'd done his Cicero as well. He'd said, OK, peroration, not very good tonight. We used to break this stuff up.
Record number two.
Number two is really Sharma Discovers Classical Music. I had a wonderful English teacher whose idea of a really great English lesson was to play Bach, a lot of Bach, and to avoid metaphysical poetry. I was knocked out by it, and I also had a friend who had an amazing resemblance to Sergeant Bilko, and he, sensing the Bach moment, stuck me in an armchair and said, just listen to this.
Yasha Heifetz playing part of the prelude to Bach's Sonata No. 3 in E major. Apparently you were a gas bag at school,
Yes, I was officially called out by a wonderful French teacher, Mr. Pasque, who used to put me in detention regularly.
The other link really one sees with what you do now and what you were then, it goes back to your mother, who apparently was a terrific storyteller.
Oh, she still is. Yes. She still is. She was born in 1911 and she has an incredible memory. I mean, one thing in East End, which she didn't tell me until about a couple of months ago, was that in 1918, a blimp came down somewhere, and the assumption was that it was full of scarlet fever germs. It was sort of panic, end-of-war panic. And she, along with her mates, had made the mistake of rushing to see it. And they were quarantined for about 2 months. And she was livid. She was a very feisty little girl who was known, when she was made to wear a silk dress for a wedding, rather than wear this sort of emerald green silk number, she scissored it to pieces, actually, on the eve of the wedding.
But you see, there, again, there is the detail. I mean, all of these little bells ring there, don't they? There is the detail, there is the appetite, your hunger for history of your own roots too. Because indeed you went off in landscape and memory.
I did, to find your mother's roots in Lithuania, didn't you? Yes, my mother's family, the Steinbergs, came from area around the Niemen River, which at various times in its history was part of Poland or part of the Russian Empire, but was great timber. Gradually, as I unpieced this sort of great-grandparental history, it was clear that we were that most oxymoronic thing, Jewish lumberjacks. Mm. I thought, this is absolutely extraordinary. You know,
when you stood there on the banks of the river, you felt the ghost, absolutely.
And then the stories my mother had told about being on the river barges and one of my great uncles having a wolf scar, who knows if it's true, but the story was always told that in hauling the timber at the beginning of the winter at night at a camp, he was attacked. And such things did actually happen. In Landscape and Memory, I thought there was one really true epiphany when I found a Jewish cemetery outside in one of these little timberland villages. The gravestones had actually literally been covered by grass and earth, but just tiny part of the stone was visible with Hebrew lettering. And these gravestones, this subterranean world of Jewish generation after Jewish generation, gradually emerged from the earth. And this was at some point a home which had been completely innocent of catastrophe and murder and cruelty. And these people had buried their families, not knowing that the horror of the 20th century would fall over them.
Next record.
This is to bring back on the desert island 60s. I had a great time in the 60s. And when you have teenage children, as I do, you keep apologising for the 60s because they regard it as the beginning of the end of Western civilization as we know it, and all you old, we don't want to hear any more about you miserable, self-indulgent hippies. And I thought, I'm fed up apologising for the 60s. I want to hear the Rolling Stones.
I saw her today at the reception. A glass of wine in her hand. I knew she was gonna meet her connection. At her feet was a footloose man. You can't always get what you want.
Rolling Stones, and you can't always get what you want. So, Simon Sharma, you went to Cambridge, where you were to get a starred first, and you met perhaps the second, maybe the third, if we count parents plus teachers, a great influence in your life, the historian Jack Plum, Sir John Plum, as he became. He taught you, you say, how to write.
Yeah.
I'm sure you already had a talent for it, but can you kind of distill how he taught you, what he was saying?
We would do incredibly close discussion of a single paragraph.
What, the writing style?
Absolutely. There was a sense that actually to make a connection, you needed really to make the furniture of the past, again, another Macaulay phrase, be physically vivid. You'd be no good as a historian if you couldn't describe, let's say, the pockmarks on Mirabeau's face. And he also said something which turned out to be very important. When you're in the library and you're looking for something really critical, very often the book, it turns out, you really want is next to the book to the one you were looking for. That was so true. I remember when I was doing boning up, and boy, I really had to bone up, for the Battle of Hastings, yet another Norman Chronicle propaganda account. Next to it was a book about horses. And I'm not from the horsey classes. I wouldn't know a fetlock if it hit me on the head. And it was all about where these horses came from. And you think of these enormous, great, you know, they were little things from Spain, mostly.
But you could go on like that forever. We all know that. But standing at the library shelf, you know, and suddenly seeing something else and something else.
No, it says, pick me. Yes. It's like going to the pet store, actually. And you're wanting to go in and get a really butch Labrador, and you come out with a little poodle, which is what we did actually once. Because the poodle says, take me.
So you were, one could see exactly how you were plugged into this kind of populist tradition through this man Plum, back through Trevelyan and Macaulay and so on. And you started teaching at Christ at 21, once you were made a fellow straight away. You stay there for 10 years, which, it does seem like a long time. Add the 3 years of being an undergrad, 13 years. For a man who's obviously full of ambition, is not always patient, these days very peripatetic. How come you stuck there so long?
I liked teaching. I was moonlighting. I mean, there was a lot as a journalist. I mean, I did work for the Sunday Times. And I was able to lead this kind of my Walter Mitty fantasy life a couple of days a week, working on the colour supplement, doing history features. I mean, you could have gone on the escalator from humble teaching fellow to whatever it was. I mean, a lot of people did this. But in the end, it wasn't for me, not to mention the rather important fact that Cambridge would never give me a job. College gave me a job. Yeah, this is rather crucial. But I was definitely not their cup of port, you know, after a bit. So,
but Oxford did.
Oxford did, bless them, yes.
But you felt like a gerbil in a treadmill, you said.
Yeah, I didn't like the curriculum. Now, I was happy in the company of fellows, and I was very happy at Oxford. I've been happy at Cambridge too, but I hated having to service the curriculum and having the sort of particular topics spelled out. And then one's baby students would go into the school exams at the end, and nothing that you taught them, even though you've been an incredibly good boy and you've done the repeal of the Corn Laws 94 times. Bulgarian partitions came out. I actually had students coming out crying from the exam room.
Next piece of music.
Oh, dear. It's I've Screwed Up My Life music from Eugene Onegin. And this song is Lenski's aria before he goes off and completes the miserable chaos and calamity of his life. It's awful and it's wonderful.
Stuart Burrows as Lenski singing his Farewell to Life from Act Two of Tchaikovsky's Eugene Onegin with the orchestra of the Royal Opera House Covent Garden, conducted by Sir George Sholty. So some 17 years, really, Simon Sharma, you were at Oxbridge. But in the last few years, you met your wife, Ginny, an American, at Oxford.
Right.
And she's now professor of genetics at Columbia University. Right. Isn't she? And in the end, both of you went off to America. This was your great liberation. Now, what about this for a theory that actually you were a late developer who had to find a good woman to give you the confidence to, you know, give your flair and originality full throttle?
Yes, I'm absolutely right.
How dare you contradict?
No, that's absolutely... No, exactly. Yes, it's either agree with that brilliant insight, how wise, how true, or get divorced. So I think I'll take how wise, how true. No, it's absolutely true. And
it is true. And you, because you then came out of that pigeonhole I keep mentioning and were allowed to roam free, it seems to me, by Harvard, all these things, and bring in art, history,
Yes, in fact, at Oxford, I was already fooling around with anthropology a great deal. I had wonderful help, actually. And I don't want to... I mean, when you said it was my great liberation, it sounds like Sharma breaks out of Colditz.
Well, that's how it reads,
it wasn't Colditz. But it just wasn't any way to bring art history and anthropology and history together. And the great thing about Harvard was that you could do this.
Obviously, that's terribly satisfying. What it also means, though, as I say, is that you can do what you want to do. And obviously, what you want to do is... It's a bit like you talking about the next book on the shelf. You seem to me to want to leap across to the next thing that inspires you. And that can even be, as I read it, sitting in a Bavarian cafe, seeing lots of women with little bits of bird in their hats, thinking, hey.
That's right. You do. I often the next thing is actually prompted by mistakes I feel I've made. And in Landscape and Memory, it was on you're exactly right, a book tour in Germany of the German translation of The Embarrassment of Riches. And I remember ending up in Munich with both jet lag, a cold, and a terrible hangover. And to come to, I was fed some nourishing soup and looked around, and there indeed there were these ladies with birds on their heads, with these little hats. They were all wearing hairy loden coats, and the old birds, partridges, seemed to have settled on their heads. I said, incredibly rudely, what is it with you Bavarians and the woods? And this did make me think, well, The Embarrassment of Riches was about a culture that was embattled with its geography, water, the Low Countries, many other places, Britain, Germany certainly. As soon as they start describing the relationship between feeling British or feeling German, talk about a countryside that they dream has never changed, in Germany's case, a serious case of woodsiness. So it's a boring, long, complicated story, but it made me enter this kind of forest of symbols.
Next piece of music.
Oh, the next piece of music is a Bob Dylan song. This one, Simple Twist of Fate, it is a perfectly conceived and executed poem. The writers I most envy are poets. Poets have this extraordinary imaginative precision, and even as my most loyal readers will know, conciseness, succinctness. I'm not really very good at that. So this is a perfect poem.
As she was walking on by the arcade, as the light burst through a beat-up shade where he was waking up, she dropped a coin into the cup above a blind man at the gate and forgot about his simple twist of fate.
Simple Twist of Fate, sung by Bob Dylan. So, Simon Sharman, within a couple of years of The Embarrassment of Riches came Citizens, 1989, right. Bicentenary of the French Revolution, another blockbuster, well, the big blockbuster,
yeah,
bestseller. Everywhere but in France. French rights never bought, I understand. I mean,
it was two reasons, both of them pretty compelling. One, everybody was writing a French Revolution history. People had serious French Revolution fatigue in France. But there was also the case that this book was represented as, quote, a Reaganite history, because I'd said rude things, not just about the terror, not rude, but I'd had a dark view of the revolution from the beginning.
Indeed. I mean, it was pretty harsh in the sense that you said that violence was the motor of the revolution. And indeed, for a while, you said it was its end, too. How did you arrive at that? I mean, how did you arrive at
that? Well, I didn't set out thinking that was going to be a conclusion. And when I said motor, I did mean that at each stage of the revolution, regimes changed when really physical force was let loose on whoever the object of current disapproval happened to be. From the beginning, the 14th of July, the taking of the Bastille ends with a kind of cold-blooded murder of the man who turned the guns on the crowd, and people are being strung up around Paris. So the sense in which actually people who are held to be responsible need to be seen to be punished was seen to me tragically always part of the formula and spoiled the party from the beginning.
But you say you didn't set out to write it that way.
I thought it would be actually happiness which would slowly darken into tyranny, which is the conventional Republican view, basically.
Mm. So how did you come upon your view?
It sounds absurdly sanctimonious by simply sort of seeing and telling the truth. I mean, there's no way around that fact.
By reading
contemporary
accounts.
Yes. I mean, if you think a bit about the Marseillaise, which is the most wonderful national anthem ever written, buried inside this wonderful song is the wish to have the blood of tyrants abreuve nos sillons, irrigate our furrows.
You apparently had nightmares when you were writing.
Yeah, I did. Not in costume, lest we think this is ridiculous. But I did absolutely have dreams of being followed down the street and put in the dock.
So, again, by definition, you are not the cool, dispassionate Olympian.
Oh, really?
You're a participant. You are the judge and the jury.
Yes,
Now, what,
right,
therefore, does the amateur reader, and presumably there have been quite a few have come to this book because it was a bestseller,
right,
people who,
right,
don't know a lot about history, what are they to take from it? Are they to read it and think, this is how it was? Or are you saying this is how it probably was? Or are you saying this is how I imagine it might have been?
No, I mean, probably was is good. You do try and get it as close as you can, notwithstanding the fact that you're removed in time and sensibility. You put yourself in someone else's shoes. If a reader comes out and says, I have been in this place as close as I will ever get to it, and I have now understood something about the human condition, that's a job reasonably well done.
Record number 6.
This is punk rock. You're talking to someone who hated glam rock. But we were stuck with it in the 70s and the mid-70s. And then improbably at a hogmanay in the Hebridean Islands, surrounded by extremely aristocratic and upper-crust people, I heard the Sex Pistols really for the first time. But there was something about the Clash and the Sex Pistols, great as they were, that was sort of pretentious. And the Ramones are just naughty boys from Queens. And the song is I Wanna Be Sedated, which they probably will put out on my tombstone when I die.
The Ramones and I Wanna Be Sedated. You've taken a similar approach to a history of Britain for BBC television, Simon. There are stories, there's a human dramas, but an intrinsic dramatic structure. It's also quite broad brush, so bits have got... I mean, the Wars of the Roses got a bit squeezed, I think.
Yes, we had the only way to do it. I mean, 15 hours is a lot of television, but it's never enough. And if you're actually going to give every king their own moment, it's impossible. It just becomes like a sprint through Madame Tussauds or something. Mm. And now there has to be a big narrative arc, does. And in order for that to happen, the cast of characters can't be too big. And to do the Richard II story and the Peasant's Revolt takes time. So we did say, uh-oh, bye-bye Richard III. And we knew there'd be countless fans of Richard III who would just be furious with us.
But you obviously love the business of television itself. You like doing the pieces together. I mean, you're the juvenile.
I was so pathetically bad at the beginning. I overperformed, really, I think. I sort of shouted at the camera. I was such an idiot. I thought, well, if notwithstanding you had the body mic, if the camera's like, 200 yards away, you had to go, hello! So there's a tremendous amount of kind of hooting at the camera and until the sweet director said, actually, we can hear you, Simon. So, oh, right.
But and your father would have been very proud of this one.
He would have liked the hooting bits, yes. No, he would have loved the whole thing. He would have loved the whole thing, I think it's fair to say.
Record number seven.
Number seven is the Life Force music. It's the beginning of the last movement. It's the last movement of Schubert's Great C Major Symphony, the Ninth Symphony. It's ultimate cheer-up music by a man who had so much sadness in his life. If I'm ever in danger of feeling sorry for myself, some critic has said something particularly poisonous. The way to stop whining is to put this on.
The opening of the last movement of Schubert's Symphony No. 9, the Great C Major, played by the Vienna Philharmonic, conducted by Sir George Scholte. Describe to me, Simon, if you will, the landscape you live in now in America, just outside New York, when you sit in your study and look out of the window
for
inspiration.
It is amazingly beautiful. It's 25 miles north of New York City. It's the Hudson Valley, which is a glacial gorge, and the air is rather pearly and wet. We can hear coyotes, which, ever heard coyotes? Mm. Sounds like 10-year-old birthday party out of control. Strange, demented cackling, actually, very scary. In March, in the spring, because there's a lot of wetland down below the hill as well, tiny frogs, the first sound of the Frühlingsnacht, the sort of spring night song, are these minute frogs called peepers. And you sit out on the deck and you hear this amazing chorus of peepers, which tells you it's not going to be that cold for too much longer.
So it's where you can work. It is where you find inspiration.
It's wonderful to work there,
And what sort of inspiration are you going to be looking for next? I do. A lot of people have said this, I think, but I mean, surely there's a novel in there.
I keep on thinking. I'm conscious of the sort of comedian who has wanted to play Hamlet. I mean, I would like to write a novel, and I'm very interested in the collision of the French and the British in Egypt, and both of their in the 1790s, and their collision with Egyptian hieroglyphs and the tombs, and a place where the boneheaded optimism of the Enlightenment meets the darkness of Ramses and Osiris. Well, sounds like not only a novel, but a really bad novel. So I'm rather intrigued by that.
But stranded on this desert island we're sending you to, how would you say, if you were never to come back, how would you like us to remember you? Would you as a historian first and a writer second? Or
no, I'd like there not to be a distinction, really. I'd like to be a historian, a writer who wrote about the past.
Last record.
Despite all this sort of shouting at cameras, there is an inward Sharma. And it's Beethoven, one of the Beethoven late string quartets, now 131, and the beautiful first movement. And partly doing this for the unscrupulous reason that it's the only quartet I know that has seven movements, so I get the sort of bonanza. And not unlike the Ramones, I have to say, Beethoven meant all of these movements. It's true. Stop laughing.
You cannot make this connection.
Absolutely can. He meant these movements to be done almost without interruption. But he wouldn't have said 1, 2, 3, 4. It's quite true, if you must.
Of the first movement of Beethoven's string quartet number 14 in C sharp minor, played by the Quartetto Italiano. You're walking into the sea music, Simon.
It is, yes. In some soupy sunset.
If you could only take one of those eight records, which one would you take?
I think it would probably have to be the Schubert, really. If I had the Beethoven, I might walk into the sunset on day one, really. So I should give this desert island a crack a bit. And Schubert would be good for get-up-and-go-ishness.
What about your book?
I think I'm going to take The Leopard by Giuseppe di Lampedusa. It's an amazing meditation on time. It's the most perfect novelised account, really, and not just something that happened a long time ago, but what time does to us. We feel it travelling through our lives. And it's very moving. At the end, there's an old dog called Bendico who belonged to this prince in Sicily in the 19th century. And the very last scene in this book is where this dog has become a rug and it's a piece of rubbish and it's thrown out the window. The very last sentences of the book are, for a moment, this dog is suspended in midair and could be seen in all his doggy animation, worst that affair. And then he became a livid heap of dust. And I thought, well, that's what historians are supposed to do. You're supposed to catch the dog in flight.
And your luxury?
My luxury is going to be Rembrandt's Bathsheba. There are going to be no women on this island, and it's going to be a completely lonely experience. It's a painting about the kind of beauty of, and also about sorrow of the relationship between men and women. But it's a fantastic eyeful, and I just have to somehow create climate control for it. Not quite sure how that's going to work.
Simon Sharma, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your
You're
Desert Island Discs.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.
Thank you.